Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you are listening to Financial Survival. Well, today is Friday, July 26, 2019, and the second and third segment today, I'm always pleased to have my conversation with James Corbett. So please stay tuned. It'll be a great two segments. He was very insightful when we did the recording earlier in the week, so please stay tuned. I always enjoy listening to James. He's, you know, not only did he take over from the late, great Bob Chapman, but James Corbett has to be very special if Bob chose him to do the lead writing for the International Forecaster and to, you know, keep it going for his daughter Jennifer and so forth. So please, ladies and gentlemen, always support the International Forecaster. I know we don't talk about it very often, and every day, there isn't a day that doesn't go by that someone says to me, boy, I sure do wish miss Bob. And I said, I do too. So we all miss Bob. And so please support James Corbett at thecorbettreport.com. And of course, the International Forecaster, theinternationalforecaster.com. Get a complimentary issue for that, but make sure you subscribe. I know there's a lot of things that are free on the internet. It's, we can get our, you know, we're always looking for a deal. We're always looking to save a few pennies. And I understand that and get that. And so many of the listeners have supported so many things throughout the years. So it's always so difficult to, you know, say, make sure you support these programs. And we try to do that with, it's not that we try, we do. We do support so many other programs out there. Greg Hunter, Beth for CSC Talk Radio, Butch Paul, and other ones, just to keep you guys in the know, to really get to the truth. And so that's one way that we can help. And yes, there's a lot of sensationalism out there, and a lot of analysts and reporters and so forth take advantage of that. But, you know, it should make you do a little bit of your own critical thinking as you're listening and reading these various news reports. And Pastor Butch Paul, you know, he's always struggling, so you know, always make sure you support. You don't have to send a lot. Send a couple bucks. You know, those couple bucks, you know, but it does take time. It does take time to write out that envelope. And then, of course, always your support with Discount Gold and Silver. It's so deeply appreciated. One of my customers said to me today, he says, you know, he says, well, I want to thank you for doing what you do. He says, we need you. And it's like, well, thank you, because I can't do this without you. So it is a partnership. And so we need to keep, it's difficult. You know, any partnership is difficult, so we need to, you know, keep it fresh, keep it going, and, you know, everyone thanks us, and this is our way of giving back, and you can give back by supporting just with a couple bucks so many of these programs, and I know they do thank you. So with that said, I think I already said it's Friday, the 26th of July, 2019, and let's go see what gold did today. I got a couple of reasons why, you know, gold tried to take off today. We had a high of 14.25. We're still up 260 in the New York spot price aftermarket, so we're looking at 14.1760. Silver was down 6 pennies today, 16.42. Platinum was down 4.867, with palladium down a dollar at 15.35. USDX today was up 21 cents or 0.21 points. 97.99, almost 98. Gold is doing extremely well with the USDX at 98. Gold is doing extremely well. Let's just hope it she can keep it. Crude oil. And did you notice I called gold she? Yeah. Let's hope it can keep it. Crude oil is up 19 cents at 56.21, and the paper markets today, didn't pay any attention to them today. The Dow was up 51 points at 27,192. The NASDAQ was up 91 at 83.30. S&P was up 0.75%, 3,025. 10-year yield, 2.08. European Asian markets, you know, barely not doing anything, just a little movement there. And again, it's Bitcoin dipped below 10,000 this week, 98.44, so it was down another 0.5%. So, and I think what happened today that there's a little pressure. I know all eyes are on next week with the Fed. Everyone is pretty much assumed they're going to do a quarter point. And there's a Blackstone chief investment strategist, Joseph Zeidel. But he thinks it's time that, you know, investors might get a little cautious. So he's predicting that the Federal Reserve will not deliver expected multiple interest rate cuts in the coming months, and that the disappointment will cause stocks to drop from their all-time highs. He said that these markets, like the S&P, they're not being driven by earnings. No kidding. He says there's no, these markets are not being driven by fundamentals. Where have you heard that before? He says it's really being driven by liquidity on the hopes that the Fed is going to cut pretty aggressively. We tell you this every single day. There's no fundamentals. He says, according to this person, a cut isn't necessary at this juncture. Inflation is not nearly as weak as the market expects. A lot of the cuts that the market demands from the Feds were based on this really weak inflation expectation. Economic growth is slowing. He says he thinks that we're going to maybe avoid a recession. But the point of this whole article is that the Fed doesn't have, or the economy doesn't need, a rate cut. And that was my argument. If you base rate cuts on the data that the government lies about, it should need a rate cut. If the economy is strong and all this data is correct, it doesn't need a rate cut. So, but that's what it's based on. It's based on the hopes that the rate cuts are coming and everything will be happy and, you know, happy days are here again and everybody can go back to, you know, doing what they do. So again, here's one guy that says he doesn't think that these rate cuts are coming, and but we'll see. Another interesting thing that came out today, I thought would put some pressure on the on gold. The dollar did what it was supposed to do, so I'm really surprised that gold did as well as it did today. But throughout this week, throughout the past couple of months, we've heard about all this currency manipulation that's going on with all these various countries, with China being the country that is pointed to the most. Well, and we've heard that Trump had earlier this week was that he was just going to go in there and we were going to do our own currency manipulation. Well, today he decided he's not going to intervene in U.S. currency markets after convening cabinet officials and top-level economic advisors to discuss this issue. Now, y'all know my BFF, Larry Kudlow. He was in the meeting, and I got the list of people that were in this meeting. And he said that the primary discussion at this meeting of trade principles was on ways to weaken the dollar. We know Kudlow. He's a strong dollar advocate. And I told this story. Woke up, middle of the night, Bloomberg. It's the first thing I do, turn on Bloomberg. His announcements was just being made that he was Trump's economic advisor. And the headline, sell gold, buy king dollar. He should have been fired for that, kicked out of Wall Street and everything else. You talk about market manipulations. But anyway, Kudlow was in this meeting, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue, Deputy Chief of Staff Chris Liddell, Trade Advisor Pete Navarro, and Council of Economic Advisors Chief Thomas Phillipson. They all attended this meeting. And Trump says, we got a problem, and what are we going to do about it? And, of course, this was referencing the long-running frustration with currency strength. This was President Trump's long-running frustration with currency strength, and that he sees as an impediment to closing the trade deficits. Some of these ideas that were debated was implementing capital controls. And, of course, this idea is viewed as extreme by most of the people that were in this meeting. And the other suggestion was to have Steve Mnuchin and Kudlow actively jawbone or talk down the dollar on television. So you see, ladies and gentlemen, we say this all the time on the program, too. It's not what they do sometimes, it's what they say. It's all what they say is how they can manipulate the markets. But Peter Navarro, he's the one that had advocated for intervention, but didn't make it through 10% of his presentation. And people briefed on the meeting said it broke without a decision to pursue a concerted new currency policy. They acknowledged, however, that the president hopes media appearances continue to help his cause. Mnuchin also opposed market intervention, and Kudlow, who has touted the value of a strong dollar throughout the course of his career, he appeared on CNBC, and he did acknowledge the issue, so he's already beginning to jawbone. Kudlow confirmed the White House principals opted not to intervene. And, I mean, it's one thing to intervene in the markets, which I think is what they're going to do anyway. But it's something else when you come out and say, hey, we're going to intervene in the markets. We're going to start manipulating our currency. That's something totally different. That gets them into a lot of trouble. You know, with all the trade organizations and the WTO and everything else, the just the repercussions of saying, hey, we're going in there and we're going to do this. So now they pulled that out of the media, and now they're just going to go in and jawbone and talk about how, oh, a strong dollar is good, but, you know, we do need this weakness and so forth, and hopefully these rate cuts will give us the weakness in the dollar that they need to keep this economy going. But let's see if there's anything else interesting in this article. Not really, just a lot of repetition. We all know, although Mnuchin, he did clarify, he says he is not going to advocate a weak dollar policy near term as Treasury Secretary. So he's not going to advocate it. But that doesn't mean he says near term, define near term. Or maybe he's not going to be Treasury Secretary too much longer. Who knows? But I also told you, listeners, that you know, Trump wanted a weak dollar, Kudlow was a strong dollar advocate. Somewhere along the line, those heads are going to butt, and this is the beginning of it. Trump is backing down, and if his trade deficits get wider because of this strong dollar, and we had the GDP today. I forgot to get you the reports on the GDP. It wasn't as strong. It was stronger than what most analysts had predicted, but it was much weaker than GDP was 2.1%. I'm sorry, I forgot to bring this up to you folks. GDP rose 2.1% in the second quarter. Of course, we all know that the first quarter was 3.1%. Consumer expenditures rose 4.3%. Business investment slumped 5.5%. But the part that gets me the most, and this article that I just brought up to share this with you, is from CNBC. And the article that the information that I read earlier was the biggest growth came from, and I'll let you have three guesses. Now, you only need one. It came from government. Government. Government spending. They're the ones who help propel the GDP. And let's see, government consumption expenditures, gross investments rose 5%. This is the fastest pace since the second quarter of 2009. Gee, what do you think? You think this economy is great? They've had the fastest, You know, the gross investment rose 5%, the fastest pace since the second quarter in 2009, and we only eked out a little over 2% GDP, 2.1. So, and it's coming from government, taxpayers. You know, if I want to give something back, I don't want my government telling me what I have to give back and how much. I'd rather make my own choices. But they got to keep it going. The consumer was a little bit, he was just out there spending. You know, it doesn't really matter that rates were going up. They were using their credit cards. We did have weakness in manufacturing. That has weighed on components like inventories and fixed income. Let's see what the consumer spent here. I think they spent like four. Personal consumption expenditures rose 4.3%. And this was the best performance since the fourth quarter of 2017. So, again, you know, mixed numbers, ladies and gentlemen, when you read the fine print, it just goes to show it's not as strong as what they want us to believe. See if there's anything. Well, that's about it. I want to give kudos for Trump, and I'll tell you why in a little bit. There was a report out. Remember Bernie? Bernie Madoff. Remember him? He's the guy, the notorious Ponzi schemer, Bernie Madoff. You know, had the biggest Ponzi scheme ever. Well, next to the government. The government is still in Wall Street. Those are still the biggest Ponzi schemes, but he was up there pretty good. He's 81. He's locked up. And I guess he is requesting clemency from Trump. And it shows that the Justice Department's website shows that Madoff's clemency request is pending. It's not clear when he first filed the request. It could have been during the Obama administration. But if Trump's previous opinions on Madoff and his family are any indication, the Uber crook faces long odds in winning an early release. In Trump's 2009 book, Think Like a Champion, he wrote that he said no to Madoff's suggestion that he invest in his fund. Trump said he knew a number of people who had invested their life savings with him. Trump said that he is without a doubt a sleazebag and a scoundrel without par. In fact, it was Madoff's wife that was looking for an apartment after Madoff's conviction, and Trump refused to rent his wife, Ruth, in an apartment. It can't be! It can't be! Anyway, I wanted to give kudos to Trump for the pardons that he did give to Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Two other pardon recipients were the Oregon ranchers, Dwight Hammond, and his son, Stephen. So, kudos to President Trump on that. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Finance and Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSCTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm always so pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. And, of course, you know, James is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report and also the lead writer for the International Forecaster. Now, you can view James's website by going to thecorbettreport.com, thecorbettreport.com. And, of course, you can also support his writings and also the International Forecaster by subscribing. And, therefore, you would get his weekly article that's placed in there. And there's a ton of great information. Of course, we all know it was originated by the late Bob Chapman, which I know so many of you know. So please support them. And, James, subscribe to the International Forecaster. Visit their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. Ask for a complimentary issue. James, to get started, I do want to ask you about your most recent article on the Corbett Report. The information overload, is a weapon of control. But before we get there, I'd kind of like to discuss some financial news that has been floating around. Some people have been interviewed, and John Williams, he's the founder of ShadowStats.com, and he says, be careful what you wish for when it comes to interest rate cuts. And of course, our Fed is meeting at the end of this next week. Everyone is anticipating at least a quarter point cut. But he said the other day that things are so bad with U.S. finances these days that the Fed is on the verge of a perpetual quantitative easing. He says there was zero risk of the U.S. defaulting on its debt because all the debt the U.S. owes is in dollars. And he said that he believes the Fed will make bonds worthless by devaluing the dollar. And that's effectively a default. And, of course, there's many other countries that we can use as an example. So, question, are we on the verge of an economic collapse?
Yes, I want to say so, but structurally and systemically, which is something that John Williams has pointed out for years in his excellent work. If people are unfamiliar with Shadow Stats, he has been pointing out how the numbers that we are fed on a daily basis have ultimately left the ballpark of reality. To the extent they were ever even in that ballpark, they are nowhere near that anymore. And you can see that from, for example, his real unemployment numbers or his real interest numbers, inflation. It's just the numbers that we're fed are so clearly manipulated and skewed. And you see that through things like the manipulation of the definition of the word unemployment, so that it means, well, if you're demotivated, if you've been out of work for such and such number of months and haven't found a job, then you're no longer unemployed. Why? Because now you're just not part of the labor participation force. Oh, okay. So given that complete manipulation of even the ground level of the information that we're supposed to take as reality, then yes, jiggering interest rates up and down and trying to, you know, they're fine-tuning the economy and as if the people at the Fed do have some kind of scalpel that they can go in and make surgical strikes here and there and move the economy around as if they have their finger on a thermostat is itself nonsense. The bigger picture of this is a system that has been manipulated really since its inception, but certainly even more so at this point, to essentially keep the system itself going along until such point as they do not want it to go along. And I think that's the real point of the the economic reality we find ourselves in. It is a confidence game. And like any other confidence game, the con man knows it's going to end at some point. They can't continue to con you forever. But as long as they have enough time, they can position the end of that confidence game so that when things fall out and when things go wrong, then they'll have another game for you to play, or they'll have another system in place, or they'll have things ready, the poor houses and whatever else they might have up their sleeve. And I think that's the perspective we have to take a look at this from. And I haven't seen that particular John Williams interview. I believe he was interviewed by Greg Hunter recently.
Correct.
But, right, okay. But I do know that that is essentially... I imagine that is essentially his point, is that, yes, the Fed will raise rates in order to, you know, put the cap on growth, or they'll lower rates to spur growth. But it is essentially lipstick on a pig, and the pig is the economy, and that's what they don't want you to understand. They want you to, you know, marry the pig, to extend the analogy, without really looking at what it fundamentally is. And I think that's the point. And you know, we've used the analogy before. It's the Pied Piper. I mean, at some point, the Piper has to stop playing the tune, and that's when he needs to be paid. And that's essentially the system that we're living in.
Well, you'd think with the Internet, it would actually reduce their ability to continue to con. But it doesn't seem to. Maybe it's breaking that system down to...
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, that's the thing. It's a double-edged sword, like so many other things. And the people who are wielding that sword because they are actually interested in reality and what's really going on will be able to find information more easily than they could have decades ago. But on the other flip side of that, it's much easier for the mainstream to disseminate their views, and people who are just going along to get along and tend to listen to mainstream approved opinion anyway, well, it's just going to be more efficiently fed to them. And it's just the creation of echo chambers. And the question is, you know, which echo chamber are you in?
Well, there's another writer, James Rickards, and he was talking about how that we're still stuck in the aftermath of the Great Recession. And he says the Fed isn't prepared for the next recession, and they can't get us. Who's going to bail out the Fed? There's no one to bail out the Fed when they have their balance sheet is already carrying $4 trillion.
Right. Yeah. No, that's exactly right. I think that is the proper perspective on this. We never really recovered from the 2008 calamity. It's just that it's been a process of extending that out and extending it out and extending it out. Now, of course, there are entire fields of thought that have arisen mostly in the past decade. I think they have roots that go further back, but mostly in the past decade to try to come up with a whole new way of looking at this, and it's modern monetary theory, and no, you guys don't understand. No, literally, the Fed can add as many zeros as they want for all time to the end of that, and that's a good thing because money is debt, so we should put more debt out there, and this is a good thing. This is how the economy functions, and so the real solution to spending is we need to spend more, and that's so there's entire fields of thought that are coming into vogue as a result of this, and of course feeding the delusions of, you know, AOC and people like that who want to create positive growth for the economy by creating trillions of dollars of new debt in the new Green Deal and all of this nonsense. Unfortunately, those kinds of fantasies are floating around right now, but I tend to agree that ultimately the Fed is going to not be able to continue the game at a certain point. The problem with that is the cynical take. Yes, of course, that will be horrible chaos in the economy, and it will be a bad thing for the average working person. But even worse than that, the system that they have already in view to replace the system as it exists now will be even worse, and we'll be even more thoroughly enslaved and chained to the bankers.
That's what I was going to ask you. Do you think there's already a new policy, a new monetary system already created, just waiting for... to replace
we already got glimpses of that from that 2008 crisis and the fallout from that, where in the wake of that we've had years and years of people, including the Bank of China governor, the People's Bank of China, and others have been talking for years and years, no, we need to replace the system as it exists now. We can't obviously continue to ground it all on the U.S. dollar because of the crazy things that are happening in the U.S. economy. We need some sort of international system. And the People's Bank of China governor, for example, has been pimping for years the idea of special drawing rights as the new thing to come along and replace it. And the funny thing is, you and I have been talking about this for years, so hopefully our audience is already familiar with this, but now, finally, normies are being introduced to this concept by people like JP Morgan, That's right. J.P. Morgan just, I think in the past month, released a report basically all about how the dollar is losing its world reserve currency status. Yes, yes, exactly right. And this is all part of the plan. And this doesn't mean that the dollar reserve currency system as it exists now is perfect, but no, the system we're being engineered into is going to be even more, the power and money is going to be even more abstracted from the sort of the average Main Street mom and pop store. It's going to be thrown even further up the ladder. So only the most connected of the connected globalists will really have their hands on this spigot of money that's going to be passing hands in this new system that's going to be engineered by the International Monetary Fund and other equally diffuse kind of groups that you and I have absolutely no say in. We don't even know how it functions, or, you know, who's in charge of the IMF. Does that matter? Oh, wait, that's going to be the deciding factor in the future growth of the world economy. Maybe we should be looking into things like this. But that's the new reality that I think is going to come into view. And that's why in the wake of that 2008-2009 crisis, you had, for example, at the G20 in 2009 in London, I believe, people like Gordon Brown, who at that time was the Prime Minister of Europe, saying, we're going to need a new world order to the Prime Minister of Britain, I should say. We're going to need a new world order to combat this new threat, this economic threat, because we now live in a global economy. Well, we do. We do live in a global economy. It's been structured and engineered that way, and there's going to need to be a global solution to that, right? Or a globalist solution. That's where we're going.
You know, President Trump has been talking about and been mentioning about having a lower dollar, and he's really beginning to come on a little bit strong and more. You know, his chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, you know, he's for a strong dollar, so you kind of see the two different opinions there. But I think the timing is interesting as he continues to talk about lowering the dollar. We all know, just as you explained, is he sort of maybe, I wouldn't say it a warning, but his timing with everything, I think, is a little bit, interesting that he's talking about it at this point in time. And as we talk about the new, you know, the dollar being devalued and everything, he's kind of saying, hey, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, to understand what politicians are saying, we have to look at their incentives. And the incentive of any politician, especially one that is going to be standing to be reelected in the next year, is to do whatever it takes to make sure they are elected in the next year.
True.
Their time horizon is different than someone who is looking objectively at the situation and thinking, what is the best for me, for my family, my community, for my geographical area, for the world. There's going to be different considerations. And so a politician is going to do whatever it takes to get reelected. And in this case, I think Trump understands that the bankers obviously do ultimately really do have the final say in the election, whether by literal vote manipulation and tampering and election fraud and, you know, controlling the voting booths. But not even from that perspective, just we know if the economy is going well, the incumbent's going to stand, generally, 9 times out of 10, going to get reelected. If the economy is tanking, then it's a very good chance that the people will throw the bums out and try again. So if you have that lever of control, if you are the Fed and you can kick up rates and put the economy to a screeching halt or kick down rates and start to boom, I mean, you really do get to control, to a certain extent, at least which of the two controlled options, Team Coke or Team Pepsi, people will vote for in the next election. And I think Trump understands and realizes that, which is why, to a very real extent, his job depends on making sure that they don't pull the rug out of this economy in the next year.
This is one of my pet peeves. We talk about it all the time on the program about these multinational corporations and their buybacks. I mean, when you talk about since 2010, corporations have put more money into their own stocks, $3.8 trillion. And yet it doesn't even seem, and we see how these executives, make out, they'll sell their shares and average, you know, 5 times as much stock as they had on an ordinary day. They become wealthy doing this. Such a distortion of the markets, and no one really says anything. Is anything can be done? Do you think anything will be done, or will it be done when the market is adjusted, I should say?
Yeah. Yeah, that's always the question, is in what way change can happen. And how could it be done productively is the most important question. How can we return to an economic reality without some sort of calamity? I mean, is there a way to do that at this point? And that's a very good question, because the further we get away from economic reality, the harder it's going to be to snap back to it. And, you know, there are times in which you almost listen to some of these commentators and the sort of their pontifications about the coming crash as if, almost as if they're excited about it. I certainly don't want to put in that perspective, okay, because as much as any individual might be prepared because they know what's coming, so they've been invested in precious metals and whatever, and they have their land and their bug out bag and they're prepared. Well, still, you exist in a context, and probably if you're like most people, you live in a context with a lot of people in communities who are not prepared, and no one wants to see the collapse or the sort of the rug being pulled out, because that will be painful for a lot of people. And even if you are individually prepared, if you exist in a community in a context that is not prepared, you're going to be in a world of hurt. And that's, I'm not looking forward to that or relishing that. But at the same time, the further away we go from economic reality, the worse it's going to be when we do snap back to it. So is there a way to return to it nicely? You know, can we do it a little bit at a time? Can we get the stock market somewhat more in line with reality without it all snapping back all at once? And I wish I had an answer to that. If I did, I would certainly be talking about it and promoting it, because that is, I think, going to be the question of the early 21st century, in much the same way that the question of, well, how do we resolve this roaring 20s situation 100 years ago with the boon of the American stock market at that time? How are we gonna get out of this? Because it looks like everything's going up and up and up, but that doesn't seem like reality. Oh, wait, yeah, Great Depression. You know, and then it's happened before, and we know where this goes. That's the worst part about it, is that we're not living in a historical vacuum here. We know where this is going. Can we learn anything from that lesson of the past? That's the question.
And that's what's always so troubling. We know what's going to happen. We've seen it happen. It's going to happen again, and yet everybody just plays the game and just allows it to continue. And, you know, there's voices out there, not enough to make the changes to prevent it from happening. So we wanted to touch on your main article, but I don't know if you can briefly touch on Elon Musk. Is he smoking too much, or you call him a con man?
Yes.
That he oversells and underdelivers.
Yes. Yes, I do. And I know the Elon Musk fanboys and fangirls in the audience might not like to hear that, because he does have them, because he is a compelling person, which most charlatans and hucksters and con men are. They don't get to be big-time con men unless they're good at what they do. And Musk is good at what he does. He generates headlines and attention, and he's always interesting. But unfortunately, when you look at the reality behind the surface, there's generally a lot less there than what he's selling. And a perfect example of that, from my perspective, is this Hyperloop idea that he had. Supposedly, he's stuck in traffic one day going to work, and he's like, this is stupid. We should be building Hyperloops under the cities that'll connect New York to D.C. in 27 minutes, or whatever it is that he said. And so he starts this whole new company, the Boring Company, to bore holes in the ground for these Hyperloops. And he's getting, you know, regulation approval and all of this, and blah, 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 billions of dollars. And now it turns out, after all of that, you know, actually, it's just going to be regular car tunnels rather than some kind of futuristic Hyperloop, because they're easier to do. Surprise, surprise! Yeah.
He should get together with Ocasio-Cortez. Anyway, because she wants to build a bridge to Hawaii. So anyway, we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, as we build this bridge to the final segment of the program today. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my guest today, James Corbett of The Corbett Report. Make sure you visit the website, thecorbettreport.com, and, of course, the International Forecaster. Make sure you get a complimentary issue. Subscribe. And you can visit the website at theinternationalforecaster.com. James, heading into the break, we were talking about Elon Musk. And, you know, basically you call him a con man. And you had an article about Mars and Elon Musk. Would you like to finish us up before we head on to your other report that we'd like to talk about?
Yes, I would. So, for people who missed it, Elon Musk had a series of tweets recently about his grander vision for SpaceX and his other ventures. Specifically, he tweeted out a picture, presumably of Mars, we'll put an asterisk next to that, with a big splashy Occupy Mars headline, and he said that essentially, we're going to Mars and we're getting ready for it. And someone immediately pointed out in that Twitter thread, actually, that's a picture of the moon. So in his Occupy Mars tweet, he had used a picture of a blood moon where the moon turns red. So I guess he thought it was Mars, or maybe that was actually part of it. Maybe he wanted people to point out it was the moon so he would get more attention. I don't know, whatever it is. But anyway, so... and in all of that back and forth and hilarity ensued, but people might have missed an interesting tweet he made in that, which was accelerating Starship development to build the Martian technocracy, which I thought was a particularly interesting little phrase. And I'm sure 99% of people would read over that and not think twice of it, but hopefully people in my audience might stop to think about it, because I've talked at length about technocracy, which, for people who don't know, is essentially an ideology. It's a political movement, it's a social movement, it's an economic idea, ideology, that that society is best ruled by people with specific and specialized knowledge, and generally in the context of engineers and scientists and economists, they can perfectly engineer society in various ways. And this was an actual historical political movement slash economic idea that came to prominence in the 1930s when it was actually formalized in an actual an actual corporation called Technocracy Inc. that was incorporated by a couple of men, a charlatan who turned out not to have an engineering background, as he claimed, Howard Scott, and someone that people might have heard of, M. King Hubbert, who was the Hubbert of Hubbert's Peak, a.k.a. Peak Oil. He did go on later in his career to work as a geologist for Shell Oil, where he developed his Peak Oil theory and all of that. But in the 1930s, he was helping to found Technocracy Inc. with Howard Scott. And it was this insane idea. Absolutely insane. People who are interested in it, please go and watch my Why Big Oil Conquered the World documentary for more information about the historical movement and where it came from and its idea. But essentially, they were saying that they could perfectly engineer the economy to basically eliminate all, you know, depression and recession and booms and busts and all this craziness and overproduction and underconsumption and all these problems in the economy. They could do it just by getting the right economists and statisticians and physicists and whatever in the positions of power to perfectly fine-tune the amount of production and consumption going on in the economy and regulate that perfectly down to the joule, because it was all going to be basically measured in energy production and consumption. And so their idea was to basically create this gigantic database of everything in the economy, how it was manufactured, how much energy it took to do it, and how much what was being consumed and where and when, and monitor all of that in real time, and then use that information to allot an energy budget for what they called the technate, which was essentially going to be North America, but there was going to be other technates around the world. And once they had that energy allotment, then they would produce exactly that amount of energy, and then they would hand out energy credits to every person in the technate, and that would be their money. They would use these energy credits to purchase things in the economy. So it would all balance out perfectly and blah, blah, blah. It was a crazy idea. Even crazier to think of that in the 1930s, monitoring everything in the economy and when it's being sold at the point of sale, how much and where and who bought it and all of this stuff. I mean, it's just unthinkable in the 1930s, but they were thinking about it. Well, you know, fast forward 80, 90 years, that's not only thinkable, that's actually really possible. So anyway, that's the historical technocracy movement. And that's why when Elon Musk says accelerating Starship development to build the Martian technocracy, that did pique my interest. But it's even more important because, as probably almost no one knows, Elon Musk has a very real familial connection to that original technocracy movement. His grandfather was an American-born Canadian. He grew up in Canada, but he was born in America. He lived in Saskatchewan, and he became a politician there, specifically either the research director or the actual head of the party, depending on which source you take. Maybe both, I don't know. But a very high-up person in the Technocracy Party of Canada. It was a political party based on the technocracy movement. And that party, that political party, ended up getting outlawed by the Canadian government because they considered them a bunch of subversives who were looking to overthrow the government. Well, you know, they weren't wrong necessarily about that. So they outlawed the technocracy party, and Elon Musk's grandfather was really, you know, upset about that and ended up picking up his family and moving them by his own little prop plane or jet or whatever he had, moving them a little bit at a time around the world to South Africa, where with Elon Musk's mother, who at that time was a little girl, and she ended up, of course, becoming the mother of Elon Musk, who ended up moving back to Canada before moving back to the United States, and he became the co-founder of PayPal and all of that. So he knows what he is talking about when he says technocracy, because his grandfather was a literal card-carrying technocrat, in fact, a leader of a political party. That's an interesting piece of the puzzle that most people won't get when they're studying Elon Musk.
That is fascinating. I did not know that. And so he has a little bit of history there, doesn't he? And so his comment on this was, what was his reason for...
Oh, you're expecting that there was any reason. No, there's never any explanation. There's never any reason. I mean, it's always just random bits of things here and there, and you have to kind of piece it together. But that's what I think is almost interesting about it, is that he can say something like accelerating Starship development to build the Martian technocracy and get 85,000 likes on that tweet. But how many of those 85,000 people have any idea about technocracy, what it is, its historical roots, or the fact that Elon Musk is personally familial connected to it? Probably, you know, one out of a million if we're lucky. So I just think it's interesting. Clearly, Elon Musk knows what he's saying, but most people, when he says that, don't know what he's saying.
Very good. I do enjoy learning about that, because I did not know. Your most recent article in the Corbett Report is called Information Overload is a Weapon of Control. And you start your article with these questions. Do you feel confused, listless, overwhelmed? And you talk about people, you know, scrolling through their news feeds. And it's interesting because, well, you just tell us more about it.
Well, I'll tell you the origin of this article, because this came from a very real place of my own personal situation. I, generally speaking, have an idea what I'm going to be writing about for the Weekend's Forecaster on Monday or Tuesday, start collecting information and little headlines and tidbits and things that I could include in there. And then by Wednesday or Thursday, I start writing it. By Friday, I'm finalizing it. Then generally, that's how it goes. And I generally, I'm at the beginning of the week, I have no idea what I'm going to write about. But once I see something, I'm like, oh, yeah, I need to write about that. I need to write about that. But this time, it was getting to Wednesday or Thursday, and I was like, I really don't know what I want to write about. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of important things going on, but almost like too many important things going on. And Iran and all that, that's very important, but maybe I should write about what's going on economically. And I got to a point where I was literally sitting there with my phone scrolling through my news feeds, thinking about what should I write about, and looking at story after story after story after story, and thinking, oh, that's important. And I felt that information overload in that moment. I became overwhelmed by it. I was completely paralyzed by the fact there was just so much going on, and I didn't know what to do. And that was like, oh, maybe I should write about this, because I have a sneaking suspicion I'm not the only person who's experienced this. Gone scrolling through a newsfeed for an hour, and then at the end of the hour, you sit there thinking, mm-hmm. I'm overwhelmed, I'm numbed, I feel paralytic, I didn't learn anything, I'm not going to use any of this information. What was that about, and why did I do that? And it just feels horrible. I've felt that over the years, and that was a moment where I was feeling that. So I wanted to convey that, because I'm sure we've all experienced that at some point, but we have to put that in the context of knowing. And again, this is knowing. This is not conjecture. This is not conspiracy theorizing. We know that the various apps and even the devices themselves, the phones and tablets, have been designed specifically to play on our human psychology and on our dopamine reward mechanisms in our brain to keep us addicted to that feed and scrolling and mindlessly going through information just for the sake of going through information without, you know, ever coming to some conclusion or feeling happy about it. In fact, it inevitably, over the long term, makes us feel worse and worse and worse, because like any addict, you have to do more and more just to get the same amount of dopamine that you were getting before, and it gets to the point where you're a zombie. And we all talk about it, the smartphone zombies walking around with screens in their faces all the time who can't seem to exist without having them in their pocket and walking around with them. Well, that's increasingly becoming all of us, and I don't want to put myself on a cloud about this, because I experience it too. I was just last week experiencing that very moment, and I think we have to put it in that context of this being a weapon, a weaponized technology that has been weaponized to prey on our psychology, so that we know that, first of all, not to completely blame ourselves, although obviously we do have personal responsibility here, but we have to understand, you know, this is a weapon that's been turned against us. But then more importantly, well, what do we do with that piece of knowledge is to realize every time you're picking up that device, you are picking up a weapon, a loaded weapon. You're essentially putting a gun to your head. And as I come up with the analogy later in the article, I say, well, maybe the real analogy is it's poison. And the first hit isn't going to kill you. The second hit isn't going to kill you. The 1,000th hit, you might feel a little sick from it, but it's probably not going to kill you. But, you know, the 1,000,000th hit, you know, at some point, this is going to be deadly. Not necessarily you will drop dead from using your smartphone, but at some point, the information overload that we're experiencing isn't going to be some sort of, oh, you know, that was weird. It's going to be our constant state and of paralysis. And how much will that benefit the people who are, you know, puppeteering the economy and politics and all of that? Essentially, isn't that the state that they want us in, to be zombies dependent on this technology for our little hits of dopamine?
You know, it's funny how you mentioned you were reading, and I find that when I prepare for the programs, I'll be going through the news feeds, and it's just like there's just like nothing that hits me. Mm-hmm. And it's just like it, and so I can actually, when you were, you know, describing your, what was happening to you, I think, yeah, that does happen. I thought it was just more there, it was me instead of what it's actually doing to us.
Yeah,
with
no
this information.
Yeah, and it's hard to get across this idea in a way that puts it in the perspective that I mean to put it in. I saw an interesting video recently called You Are Being Groomed that was about this idea, and it was interesting in that it connected the sort of the things that are going on in terms of the smartphones and devices and the way they're being weaponized against us to grooming. You know, the way that a sexual harasser will groom their victims and put them in a context where they are dependent on this person who is going to be abusing them. And that's a horrible situation, and it leads to people being trapped in these relationships that they at a certain point they realize, I'm in this horrible abusive relationship, but I don't know how to get out of it. And that's essentially what these technologies are doing. And the real long-run picture of this, again, that I find it difficult to really communicate to some people the importance of this, the real long-term vision of this is ultimately going to be the interfacing of the computer technology itself with humanity. Interestingly enough, this connects right back to what we were talking about, because people might remember one of those big splashy projects that Elon Musk, the charlatan, came out with a few years ago, Neuralink. He was going to create this neural lace as his solution to the problem of artificial intelligence. Elon Musk is one of the people, there's quite a few these days, but one of the people warning AI, artificial intelligence, is going to basically eliminate humanity. At some point, the computers are going to take over and they're not going to have any need for us. So his solution to that is, well, then we better merge with the machines and incorporate AI into our physical bodies so that the computers can't just get rid of us, because they'll be part of us, kind of thing. It's an insane idea, but hey, it's his idea. And so he started this company called Neuralink, and it's been under this shroud of secrecy for a couple of years, but literally just in the past week he had this big press conference about the progress that they've made in terms of having these tiny little transistors that they can embed in your scalp in this tiny procedure. They want to make it like LASIK eye surgery, you know, same day in and out kind of thing. It's not even a big deal and anyone can do it, and essentially implanting technology in your brain to read your brain waves and manipulate them in various ways. And ultimately this is going to come, I mean, they're selling it as, you know, cripples can type with this technology just by thinking the words kind of thing, but ultimately this is going to be about incorporating the technology directly into our nervous system so that we control the technology and the technology controls us. But that's the kind of asterisk that they tend to leave out there. And this is the game for all the marbles. This is the future of humanity.
How far away do you think we are to something like that?
I'd like to imagine centuries, but unfortunately, I imagine decades at most.
And we just have a few seconds until we're up the program. James, thank you so much for joining me today. Listeners, get to the website, thecorbettreport.com and theinternationalforecaster.com. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, be safe, good night, and God bless. Thank you, James.